Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. Shortly after the winter retreat ended, we had a couple of guests here. Ajahn Pasano's mother, Rhoda, was here. And Ajahn Punidamo came down from Canada, and Ajahn Siddhanto was visiting. And one afternoon, we went over to Mount Tabor, which is the Christian monastery next door. And we're given a very gracious and lovely tour of the monastery. I was thinking, during the early days when I first arrived, even as a layperson, especially I came and lived here for about 3 months as a layperson before I even decided to ordain here. We had a very close relationship with the monastery next door. It was in particular with one of the monks that was very open and friendly with us. And I remember. It was probably when I was a layperson, but I think it happened a few times, even when I was Nanagarika, was on our all-night observance nights. Our chanting starts at 3 in the morning, and 3:20, 3:30, we're finished. And then their morning service, first service, would be 4 in the morning, so I would go over and listen to their chanting and go. And as a result of that, I got to know several of the fathers there and a couple of the brothers quite well. And I remember when I did ordain, I took my family over. They were here for, it was my Salmonera ordination. And so I took my family over there because most of the monks knew me. And we arrived there and all the monks came up and said, "Ah, Jyoti Paulo, Jyoti Paulo, it's good to see you." And I was like really shocked because I didn't even know my own name at that point. He was Salmonera Kantiko can probably attest to that. That takes a few weeks for you to really get used to your new name. And so they all knew my name. And I was like, "How did you guys know that?" And like they knew me so well, they had called over to the monastery. You know, they knew my ordination was that day. So they called over to the monastery and found out my new name. And then they said they were going around all day long saying, "Jyoti Paulo, Jyoti Paulo, Jyoti Paulo," while trying to remember my name. So when it came over, they could all greet me, which is we had this really sweet, you know, connection with them. And then I won't get into I don't even know if I even know the whole story, but when the abbot there, who was the founder of the church, sort of stepped down and retired, there was a kind of a internal, you know, shift of perspectives, and the monk that we knew really well ended up leaving. And so even in that time period, though, since that period, which is about my novice year, up to the present, we've had a very good relationship with the monastery there. They've helped us out with various projects we've had to do, just being next door neighbors, you know, land issues, and sometimes spiritual issues. You know, we've been in contact with them, and every year at Christmas we go over and make a little Christmas gift for them. And it's been a nice relationship with them. But just recently, that monk who we had really close relationships has returned, and he's now the father abbot of the monastery, and his name's Father Damien. And so it was really, when I heard that Ajahn Pasano was going to take his mother and the other monks over there, I asked if I could go along just because I had this, you know, really nice relationship with them. And kind of to, you know, this relationship I have with Father William, I was just thinking about this during the sit, which, and it isn't actually what I was thinking of talking about tonight, but this kind of relationship we have with them was, at one point I was having some issues with somebody in my life who I would consider to be like, a fundamentalist Christian. I don't know if it's actually true or not, but, and you know, it said some pretty hurtful and mean things, and I was pretty shaken up by it. And so I asked Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro if I could go over and talk to Father Damien about it. And you know, they were very supportive of that. And so I went over and had this interview with them. And I remember we were sitting in their, I guess you call it like refectory, where they eat their meals. We were sitting there on these benches across from each other. And I was telling him the story. And as I was talking, you know, I just saw this visual softening in his face. You know, and he didn't do this, but it was almost as if, you know, like he started to cry. You know, like listening to me, it's just this lowering of the shoulders and the softening of the face. And just when he did that, something clicked within me, and I looked at him and I said, "Oh, you deal with these issues too, don't you?" You know, sort of being judged and being, you know, told he's wrong, and because they practice a, say, Eastern Orthodox kind of religion, you know, type of Christianity, and then when I said that, his head just sort of completely collapsed onto his chest, and then he just did this sort of nod, you know, with his head in his chest, and then in that moment there was just like, for me, there was a sense of, you know, this is a really great being that I'm with, you know, because it's like, when I was telling him, you know, my suffering, you know, he could really connect with it. You know, he was there fully for, you know, what I was going through, and then, you know, to acknowledge that, you know, with this, you know, this sense of just presence of being there. He didn't actually say anything. You know, it was just this sense of, oh, I really got it, that he understood where I was at. And then in my response, it's like I actually acknowledged his feeling of that. And then just in the, you know, in that sense of my, you know, I would say like calling him out on it, but just sort of, you know, saying, oh, do you experience that as well? And then it was just like, he just like completely collapsed. You know, it was just like he went completely into his suffering. And, you know, and he knew I was there to support him, and, you know, he was there as a spiritual teacher, but he was giving me a lesson that, you know, it's okay to, you know, to go completely into that, you know, to be supported, to have, you have a community, you have a teaching, you know, you have, there is a refuge, you know, there's, you can get through that. And so it's just, you know, that's the kind of relationship I have with the, or this respect I have for Father Damien. So when I heard that the, you know, Jampasana was going over, I really wanted to go over because I hadn't had a chance to connect with him since he's been back. And then another connection I really have with Father Damien is that he's an artist, and I've talked a little bit about using art as a spiritual practice, and sort of at least from the perspective of doing the painting, of how I use that for raising energy, having a sort of dedicated practice and you know, devotional aspect of it. And I've been working on that for a few years, and so I was kind of, you know, looking forward to going over and just being around Father Damien for that reason. But then when we were there, he did take us into the church and the kind of like chapel area, and their chapels, it's probably about the same size as this room, but it seems like it's about half the size of it, and it's all like this really dark wood on the inside, or maybe it's like kind of like a cedar. So you come into it, and there's this real strong sense of smell of the wood, and it's dark inside. It's probably not, but I kind of get the impression when I'm in there, it's like it's being lit by candlelight, and there's all these, you know, stained glass windows. It really is this, you know, the Ukrainian Eastern Orthodox, you know, sort of appearance to the place. And there's dozens and dozens of these really beautifully painted icons in the top part of their shrine is like all these very large panels, you know, probably like, you know, like the size of doors, and there's sort of different levels to the doors and different you know, you say different heights, different widths of the doors, and some of them have like an opening on the top, and, you know, sometimes you go in there and sometimes the doors are open and sometimes they're closed, and even above the doors, like the whole front wall is painted in this really traditional icon style. So there's lots of gold and, you know, angels and saints, you know, painted on these. And, you know, when I look at it, it does bring a sense of you know, the holy, you know, that this is definitely a religious iconography. And there's that sense of, you know, peace that comes over from just being in that. And also, I think like every single time I've ever gone into the chapel there's been, you know, somebody inside praying or chanting or you're reading the Psalms or something. So you just, every time I go in there, there's this sense of that. And there's also, they do a lot of burning of incense. So you just come into it and you know you're entering into like a practice, a space of practice, a place of devotion. And then when we had this tour, then it was really beautiful that Father Damien was sort of, you know, well, one thing is too, is like when I look at the artwork or, you know, look at the icons, I don't actually look at them and see them aesthetically beautiful. I don't think they're ugly, but I also don't, you know, I don't like, wow, this is really beautiful. I wish I had one of these in my cabin. Or I don't see it as artwork. I see it as, you know, I can see it as crafted very beautifully and very thoughtfully. And but one thing looking at it is I don't understand it. It doesn't, you know, it's like, well, why are they? Why are, you know, who is that for one thing? I don't know who the people are. I can't read the writing because it's usually in a either Ukrainian or Hebrew or something like that. So I can't read it. Don't know the Christian stories. So I can, you know, looking at it, it doesn't bring up that sort of sense of devotion. And I think that was the case for almost all of us, except for Ajahn Pūnadamo. He actually grew up in that exact church in Toronto, so he probably did know a little bit more of the stories, what was going on. But Father Damien was actually the person who painted all of the icons, especially the ones in the front of the shrine. The ones on the side, he may or may not have painted all of them, but definitely the shrine, you know, he had painted that. And so then he started going through and explaining the elements of, like, you know, what the significance of the doors meant, or the who the paintings were of, and, you know, what, you know, historically or, you know, spiritually what their significance was. And I remembered one of the angels on the side had a you know, blue robe on, a blue, like, tunic, and was wearing a band across the head that had a jewel on the band on the forehead. And he was explaining to us that, you know, he chose those colors because in ancient Rome, that particular robe was a postal carrier. That was, so he was painting, you know, this angel as a postal carrier. So it was, you know, bringing messages from, you know, from God down to the human realm. And so it was, you know, the iconography actually had a meaning. And then the jewel in the forehead was, I guess during that time period, that, you know, regular postal carriers wouldn't be wearing jewels, but a royal carrier would be. You know, like if it was someone working for the emperor or somebody of extremely high class, they would be, the postal workers would be wearing jewels. So it was a message, you know, this is not only a messenger, but it's a messenger of the highest high. And so so it was really powerful for me, you know, sort of, you know, looking at these images with, you know, somebody who actually did the paintings, and, you know, explaining what all the iconography meant. And then I could, you know, totally appreciate it in a much deeper level. And the thing I came away with mostly from that was that how Father Damien was able to use, you know, his skill and his love in painting as a way for him to talk about his faith. So it was, you know, the whole icon, you know, to him, it, you know, it, I haven't had a whole lot of conversations with him, just one or two on the phone since then, but I was explaining to him, well, actually while we were there, I just casually mentioned that I also do painting, and he just immediately invited me to come, and he does icon workshops, and they're like, I just found out yesterday or the day before that they're like 4-day workshops, and he has one coming up in a couple of months. But he immediately invited me to come and participate in the icon workshop, and so I was, you know, really excited. And he does it in a really, you know, the ancient style, and so I don't, you know, really know what's going to happen. But so I was over the, it was in, let me say, cloud nine when he invited me to come. And so hopefully that will happen. But in the meantime, then I was talking to him on the phone just initially about some of the details about that. And he just sort of asked me, like, what kind of artwork do you do, and what do you get from it? I forget exactly what the question was, but I was telling him that I'd been kind of dabbling on and off with painting, say Buddha images, and basically took pictures of Ajahn Chah, and was working on just like say two or three images for years, just sort of painting the same images over and over again, and using that as a practice to actually learn a skill, because I had been an art major in college, but I'd never really mastered or had much even interest in doing portrait kind of artwork, and was not very good at that. And so he just spent, many, many paintings. Many of them just ended up as a fire starter. it's not auspicious to throw away sort of iconography and images and stuff like that. So like in at least the way I've been trained, like say Dhamma books and things like that, is when they've no longer are useful or readable and things like that, you're supposed to burn them instead of throw them away. So I would always, even though they were not very good images, I would always say burn them or dispose of them. So many paintings just didn't end up seeing the light of day. And but slowly over many years, I started getting maybe like one in four, one in five paintings would actually come out looking fairly human. And in those, I would end up giving away to people, and then I slowly, over time, after a year or two, maybe was able to get pretty close to the image that I was hoping to get. And then I kind of, after that, I lost interest for a while, kind of set it aside, and probably went like 3 years without doing any more painting. And then it was 2 years ago during our winter retreat. I think I talked about this before, but I was. We were in a particular part of our retreat where there was no schedule at all. It was completely open. We just had to be here for probably a reading right before the meal, and be here for the meal, and the rest of the day was completely open. And at that particular day, anyway, I've been doing walking meditation all day long. It was just like a really beautiful day, so I just wanted to be outside. And I remember, about 8 o'clock in the evening, I came into my cabin, and I was physically exhausted, because I had just literally been walking for hours, and the mind was really quiet and peaceful, but I just knew if I sat down and meditated, I would just fall asleep, and I was thinking, it's 8 o'clock right now, and if I go to sleep, lay down now, I knew my tendencies is that I wouldn't want to get up till four anyway, and then I'd be really stiff and feel just not so good the next day, so I realized I have to do something to stay awake. And at the time, I had, from like 3 years earlier, I had three drawings that I had, initial drawings that I had done, or four. I had four drawings of Ajahn Chah that I wanted to, that I had started to do his paintings. I had the drawings done, and but just left them and didn't pick them up. And at the time, I had read this book Ajahn Yaniko had loaned me about Lakota, Native American spirituality. And when I was reading the book, I had this image of doing four paintings of Buddhas that would kind of look like Native Americans in Lakota style. And it's kind of interesting with the story was that the book was about Wallace Black Elk as a Lakota medicine man in the north or South Dakota, I can't remember which, and. But I read the book and had this image, and I remember thinking, I saw my paints off in a box that I had in the corner of my kuti, and I thought, why don't you just, at least for an hour, try to stay awake till at least 9, maybe 10 o'clock, just do a little bit of painting. And so I got the paints out and started painting them, and I was finishing the fourth painting. I did all four paintings in one sitting, and I looked over the clock, and it was like, I'm guessing now, I can't exactly remember, but it was like 2 or 3 in the morning. So like 6 hours had passed, just like nothing. It was just like 1 minute had passed, but I'd been up for 6 hours and completely wide awake and full of energy. And I remember thinking to myself, pay attention to that. There's something about that. The mind was really interested. The mind was very happy. And even though it was like the body was completely exhausted, that, you know, something with the mind was able to easily overcome that fatigue, you know, and find interest in it. So then I slowly started to talk to Lumpur about it and got some advice on how to possibly use painting as a aid to meditation. And what was interesting about those four paintings, though, was I took a photograph of them and sent them to my mother, and her best friend in high school ended up anthropology, studying of like native cultures and things, and she was studying Lakota, and she actually got adopted into this Lakota family, and like their best friends or neighbors or something like that was Black Wallace Ellis's sister. And so I was like, wow, this is totally amazing. And so I just gave those paintings to my mother's friend, and then she ended up giving those to Wallace's sister. And Wallace's has passed away, but so it's kind of really interesting how things like that work. But then what I started, you know, doing was, you know, with my, you know, personally with the painting is, and, you know, I think this is really kind of important, is that that when I started doing it, and even to this day, even though now I've been doing it for at least a year and a half, sort of, you know, almost every single day, doing some sort of aspect of working on these paintings, but especially the first 3 months of when I was doing this, was whenever I would start doing it, I would totally lose track of time. You know, it was like time would just wouldn't exist. And, you know, during this time, it's like we were still doing, you know, all the work that we're doing during the day, and you would be physically tired. You're not getting back to your cabin until sometimes 9 o'clock or later. You know, but I'd want to paint. It was like, you know, there was this, you know, desire to want to do that. So there was the Pali words, chanda, this real desire to do that. And partly it was because it did quiet the mind. There was a real happiness and joy that came from doing that. And there was a kind of like a, you know, a high that you would get from doing that. And the mind, you know, wanted that. So I would do it. But I actually had to set my alarm so I would actually go to sleep. I find that hilarious, you know. So I had to set it for midnight, so I could get up at 4 o'clock and have a little bit of sleep. And again, I was, you know, consulting with Ajahn Pasno about all of this, and you know, one of the, you know, I kind of came up with the guidelines or the rules for me about this, but they were basically, you know, as long as I'm not starting to miss any group activities, you know, sort of like, you know, I'll stay up all night long painting, but, oh, because I was up till 3, I can skip morning puja, you know. But so as long as I don't, you know, start neglecting my duties and responsibilities, as long as I'm not, like, too tired that I can't function, or it, you know, starts making me irritable, or I don't want to be, you know, doing the things that are required by living in a community, as long as I can, you know, still do all of those things, you know, then I will still, you know, I'll still pursue, I'll be open, I'll, you know, investigate this as a practice. But if I can clearly see, or people point out to me that, you know, my behavior isn't in line, then I would obviously, or not obviously, but I would, you know, stop doing those or alter it in some way. You know, what I found interesting, though, is that as, when I was forcing myself to go to sleep at midnight, and, you know, getting up at 4 for morning puja, was the, you know, for, and I don't say for some odd reason, but the I have had a tendency in the past to be a nodder in the morning meditation, one of the, we call headless meditators, with the head on the chest, but I noticed, like, you know, only getting significantly less sleep because I was up till 4 or up till midnight, significantly less sleep, but I was much more awake in my meditation. Not that maybe the concentration was totally there, but I was definitely awake. And so I started investigating, well, what's that about? You know, why is that? And, you know, what comes to my mind is this fact that the, you know, doing these other activities that are nourishing the mind, you know, just finding some aspect of our life that we that is wholesome and that, that we enjoy doing. You know, there's many monks here that that really enjoy, you know, say, working in the workshop. You know, in the afternoon you might find them there doing various work projects, and it just brings them, you ask them why they do it, and it's because it brings them joy, you know, to be giving service to the monastery, or they see a need and they want to be doing that. And and some of these monks I know, you know, also get by on sometimes 4 hours of sleep at a time, even though they are physically, you know, working a lot. And there's some monks that you know, get a lot of joy from study. So sometimes there's a building out, big, large building out in the monastery that's, we call the MUB, Monks Utility Building, or the Bhikkhu Commons, and there's a little library there. It's not uncommon to find monks up there studying Pali or reading suttas or, you know, doing that. And, you know, you ask them why they do it, and it's because it makes them happy. You know, it's something that their minds are inclined towards. And then there are monks, too, that just do just like getting back to their cabins, and you go to their, if you went to their cabins, their, you know, their walking paths are really well used. You know, they get out and do walking meditation in the afternoon. You know, when it's that first period of time after the meals, you know, really can be quite difficult to stay awake. So you know, they go out and do walking meditation, and then when the drowsiness is over, and they can, you know, either, you know, have a mosquito netting, which you need right now at this time of the year if you're outside, but or go into their cabins, and you know, and they get the happiness and joy from meditating, you know, to investigating. So it's interesting. You know, there's different ways to bring that up for different individuals, and it changes too. And so this is what I've been, you know, kind of contemplating and thinking about. And so especially when say Father Damien invited me to the Icon workshop, and especially his you know, what I would say was most impressed with is how he used the artwork. And I haven't talked to him, but, well, actually I did. When I was talking to him on the phone, I actually explained to him very briefly, like, you know, how I was having to set my alarm to go to sleep at night. And this is his words. He says, "Oh, you have the gift." He says, "You know, that is your." He said, "That's your calling." In probably in Christian terminology, he's like, "Oh, you know, that's." He's like, he was like practicing mudita. He's like, "Oh, that's, you know, that's probably your calling. That's your, you know, he may not be right, and it may be changing, but he says, you know, when you find something, some aspect of your practice that you really find delight in, then, you know, that you should not necessarily exclude everything else, but, you know, do pay attention to that." And Sri Ajahn had said, you know, something similar to me, and I asked him, you know, if that was the case for him too, and he said, "Yes, it was." You know, that was what brought him. There's probably other aspects as well, but that was one of the things that has allowed him to be a monk all these years. Is that joy. And so, you know, I've been thinking about both those, the visit and the few conversations I've had with him. But they say, well, yeah, what really impressed me was his how he used his artwork, not just as a way of, you know, practicing, but, you know, as using it as a way for him to teach, to help connect other people to what he was doing. And then one of the other monks here has been sort of feeding me little Dhamma talks and little. He handed me a note the other day, really, really beautifully. It said, "It's like 10 qualities of 10 benefits of creating Buddha images. Like all these sort of wonderful qualities that you develop by you know, or maybe even like." These will be the results of, you know, sort of devoting a life to making Buddha images. And then he sent me a couple of links to a couple of talks. It was to one talk on, it was this Tibetan scholar. I talked about it yesterday during the morning reflection about, well, it was a series of talks he gave on, it's actually just the recollections of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and when he's talking about the Buddha, he gets into the 32 marks of a great man, the 32 marks of a Buddha, and it was I found the talk totally fascinating. But one of the things I was teasing this monk, because the very first thing he says is that there's two different schools in Tibetan Buddhism, and one says that there's of these characteristics and of the dimensions of the Buddha, and there's a very, in one particular school of say Tibetan Buddhism, there's a very exact way you're supposed to represent the Buddha in paintings, and if you do it wrong, you're creating extremely bad karma. Maybe even the karma that could like send you to hell. So I was like, why is this monk sending me this? Why does he want me to listen to this Dhamma talk? teasing him, giving him a hard time. And he said that was only one of the schools, though. But then this teacher goes through all these different 32 marks. And it was a really beautiful, I found it was a really beautiful, beautiful talk, because he's mentioning, what he keeps stressing is that it's, like the 32 marks of the Buddha, if you read them, they sound really, some of them sound quite strange or impossible or not actually very inspiring in some ways. But what is inspiring is those, the qualities, the causes for what supposedly is the manifestation of those. And like I've read the sutta, and rarely do you ever kind of hear Dhamma talks. And I was asking a couple of the monks, a couple that lived in Thailand for a long time, and they said they've almost never have heard talks on that. It's a kind of one of those things where it's, well, even this monk who was, or this scholar who was talking about him, what I found refreshing was that as he was talking about these to his students, and of course they had all these doubts, and it was kind of fun too, because they weren't doing it disrespectful, but as they were going through a lot of the list, there's lots of laughter, kind of like, how can that be? And it didn't sound disrespectful at all, and it wasn't intended that way, but there's a lot of laughter and like just trying to imagine what a person would look like with some of these marks on them. But the teacher kept coming back to her. They were like, how can that be? And the teacher was like, well, I don't know, why it says that or why this cause is there. This is, I'm just coming back to, this is what is in the suttas, and pointing that out, and then really kind of challenging the students to. One of the beautiful things about that talk was that it was looking at things in terms of like, well, yeah, this is what's said in the suttas, but like you were reading an English translation, and those were probably of Tibetan scriptures, which probably came from Sanskrit, which maybe then came from Pali, so it's translation of a translation of a translation. And then sometimes he would, of that same sutta, there's like two different, completely different suttas in the Tibetan. They have, the order's not exactly the same, or they may have, some of them they had three sets of two, where they had combined two of them in three different places, and they had one of the sutta had three completely different marks as the 32 marks. And then he's describing one of the suttas in English, and then I guess this, it's interesting, I just asked this monk about this, and the teachings are all in English, but I guess this monk, or this scholar is living in Germany, but it was, all the teaching was happening in English. I thought that was interesting, but they did have a German translation of the Pali Sutta, and it had an English translation. And he was asking one of his students to read what the translation was of the German, and they realized that it was like the numbering system was different. And so, like, what was supposed to be number 16 in the English and number 16 in the German was different. What came up for the teacher when he was talking about this, though, is it's like, he just really showed him that, that I was trying to point out to the students that you really, when you are reading the suttas, that you do have to kind of take it, open-minded and, not necessarily, trusting or believing everything you read, but trying to, take it with a discriminating mind. But one way that I felt he really made this beautiful was that, he kept telling the students, not to look at the physical aspect of it, but to look at the causes, you know, what were the causes to make those things come about. And it's interesting, like some of the causes, if you looked at what the suttas would say would be the physical manifestation, you really couldn't sometimes tell, like, okay, why would that be? You know, why would you get that physical characteristic? Like the one I can, you know, think of off the top of my head is that the Buddha, and this was at least in the Tibetan version, is supposed to be about 8 to almost 9 feet tall. And so he was, he said the average person would be 4 cubits tall, and the Buddha was 7 cubits tall. So he's like, you know, that much, almost twice the size of a regular human being. And but the cause of that is that he perfected the precept of not killing, and not harming other beings. And so you can look at it as like, well, if you want to, like with a critical mind, if you read the Pali Suttas, we'd say, well, that's ridiculous. The Buddha wasn't 8 feet tall, wasn't 9 feet tall, because there's actually several instances where a wanderer of a different sect or somebody's coming and wants to debate the Buddha or wants to have a dialogue with the Buddha, and they can't distinguish him from any of the other monks. You know, they from those suttas you can, if you believe the Pali Suttas, you know, that he was maybe, you know, a little bit different, you know, a little inch or two taller than everybody else, but he wasn't twice the size of everybody else, because it would have been pretty obvious to pick out who the Buddha was. And or if all the monks were 9 feet tall, you know, you don't hear about the, you know, it's not in the suttas. So you can look at it critically that way. But if you just look at it as really reading the sutta and just looking at, well, what are the causes? There's none of the causes to manifest those 32 parts seem that unreasonable. You know, they're all extremely beautiful. They're like, yeah, these are wonderful qualities to develop. And so, yeah, listening to that teaching, and what's come to my mind, and why I'm kind of, you know, talking about this tonight is that also with the anticipation of going to the icon workshop, is it comes up the question, and that this teacher brings up this question of, you know, can you use art to teach? You know, it's like in the Tibetan tradition, the Sambhogakaya, which is the physical manifestation of the Buddha, and he talks about sort of three different versions and three different ways that they talk about it. And one is the Buddha manifesting as these 32 special marks. One of them is called an artist Buddha. And then one of them is the holy being Buddha. And I don't totally know, you know, the difference between all of those, but he does bring up there's only one classic example in the Tibetan tradition of the artist Buddha, which is he gets into a duel with a celestial musician, and he points out that even in that particular Tibetan sutta, the Buddha isn't sort of converting people to Buddhism because of his concert. You know, he's not giving a concert that the music is just so beautiful that people convert or people understand the Four Noble Truths because of the teachings, but it was the teachings very specifically to that particular deva, who had a wrong view about that deva's personality view. He was kind of arrogant and conceited, and the Buddha, you know, challenges him to a musical contest, and the Buddha wins, and it's just to humble the musician to get him to you know, kind of have more of a you know, proper view of himself, to maybe open, and then opening himself up to the Buddha's teachings. And then he sort of says, you know, he can't think of any other, you know, sort of examples, you know, of that, but me that came to my mind is the Dhammapada, you know, the Buddha as a poet, you know, very, you know, in the suttas there's all these very spontaneous uses of poetry. And then also one thing is that the teacher himself, when he's really skillful, because he just keeps, you know, sort of asking his, you know, various questions around, you know, using art as a way of teaching, and you know, two things that he comes back to that I, you know, I kind of agree and that I agree with is that learning using artwork is it's a doing, and he points out that in various traditions and various schools, especially kind of maybe, you know, Mahayana, Japanese and say Chinese, you know, there's a lot of very specific and very detailed, you know, trainings around like calligraphy painting. And I guess in this class that he's teaching, there's a Korean master icon or a calligraphy painter in the class, and he said, you know, there's two different schools of sudden and gradual sort of teachings in calligraphy, and schools of pottery, there's schools of archery, there's, you know, the tea ceremony, there's all sorts of, you know, flower arrangement, many different types of martial arts, training that have been developed in these Asian countries. And he points out that, you know, like every single one of those and many others that I'm not thinking of, the student learns by doing it. It's not something that you read in a book. I mean, you can read about it in a book, and you actually might get some insights. You might have a better appreciation for that particular art, but you're only going to master it if you get the bow and arrow out and, you know, learn the difference between different strings on a bow, or the different types of wood, or the different weights, or different types of arrows, different conditions that you're shooting into, or maybe humidity of that particular day makes a difference. And so you learn by practice, you learn by experience, and it's a doing. And so he points that out with, you know, sort of all these different arts. And so that's for myself with say portrait painting and trying to do icons. You know, that's, you know, definitely the case that I can see that there's a learning. You know, and then in terms of spiritual qualities. You know, like you're developing, you know, patience, you're learning to raise up energy, you do learn concentration and mindfulness, especially with, like, say, mindfulness, there's, you know, memory of, you know, things that you've done that worked before and things that didn't work, and, you know, trying to remember those things. So there are many, you know, different qualities that then, you know, that those, you know, when you learn them in one aspect of your life, can be brought over into other aspects, into meditation or in here in the Thai forest tradition, you know, a lot of the meditation, you know, the vast majority of our day is not sitting in meditation. You know, it's carrying lumber out to work sites, or cooking, or washing dishes, communicating with each other, being in, trying to communicate sometimes very complex ideas to other people, to try to develop harmony, or to develop something in the monastery. You know, trying to learn how to empathize with other people. You know, to see somebody in pain, and to try to learn how to connect with that, and how to, you know, just to be real with each other. So there's all these. You know, you can learn something from one medium, and then take that and incorporate that into our daily life. And then just this afternoon, I just went to good old Google and typed in, you know, something around, you know, can you teach using art, or something like that, and a couple of websites came up, and there were a couple of lists that the different newspapers had written articles. There's been lots of studies out where, you know, they'll take controlled groups where they'll have certain, you know, age group of kids, who have been doing certain training and in particular art as an education, and then other study groups that didn't have that, and then seeing the different results in the students, and of course they're biased like I am, and they're gonna at least show the results that art does have an effect. But I wrote down one of the lists here that they came up with. Well, like these four. This is from a professor at Stanford, Elliot Eisner. He came up with a list of 10. I'm just going to read the first four. He says, using art, as a way of, for studying and teaching. It says, unlike the curriculum in which correct answers and rules prevail, in the arts it's judgment rather than rules that prevail. Number two was, the arts teach that problems can have more than one solution and that questions can have more than one answer. Three, the arts celebrate multiple perspectives. And four, arts teach that in complex forms of problem solving, I'd say solutions are seldom fixed but change as circumstance and the opportunities change. I like those four. And then another list, one of the things I liked, and sort of about what you kind of learn from, I'd say, artwork or art is problem solving. Also, I like this one. When you're an art student in particular, it's that you learn how to receive constructive feedback. And when you're an art student, that's a really significant part of being an artist is. Because you do have sometimes a very complex or maybe a very simple, like just an emotion that you're trying to learn how to express, and you attempt it, and then in an art class you would a lot of it is not just getting the feedback but also learning to give feedback as well, and learning how to critique somebody and give them constructive feedback. So in that, but the learning how to receive the feedback, like, so you do have an idea, and I do remember that's like a significant part of when I was in college taking art classes. That was a significant part of the classes, was putting your ideas and perspectives out there, and then letting people tear it down sometimes. Learning to do your best. Have an idea. Have go forward with a project, and then let it go. That's what you produced. And then if you can literally let it go and not be attached to it, not see it as self or importance. Like I have to have everybody like this, or I have to have everybody understand it. But to put it out there, and then then to learn. Like people say, well, I don't understand it at all, or. When I see that, this is how I interpret it, and then you can learn how other people, how other people think, how other people perceive things, and so you can you learn more about the empathy of how to relate to other people. So getting the connecting with other people and the feedback is really important in that that quality of learning a skill, learning an art. This, I would say the same thing applies here. Like we have an idea of, like I want to try to convey this message to somebody. There, you might feel like someone's doing something not in a beautiful way, and so you come up with a creative solution to that, and you present it kind of as a piece of artwork. I'm going to give this people someone some constructive feedback, and then they don't receive it well, and then it's like, okay. And then learning to self-critique. Okay, well, what went wrong? What did I not convey, or how did they interpret that differently? Being able to interpret that or see that from a different perspective. And realizing that again, like one of those points was seeing that there's more than one solution. So like, okay, that solution wasn't the right one, but maybe there is one, or maybe there isn't a solution. Maybe the solution is to learn to surrender, to let go. I guess the kind of last thing I'll kind of end with is that with the icon, sort of workshop and painting is, Yeah, I'm personally just sort of looking at like all the paintings I've done so far. Really feel like they have been this sort of learning the technique of painting and using it as a way of really helping with my own, you know, personal meditation and you know, again, hopefully, you know, being in the community and being more mindful and aware. But yeah, I am intrigued by this, like, you know, how do you use art as a teaching technique, and you know, what would that be, you know, what would that look like, you know, how would you do that, you know, developing it as a workshop. Like I'm really interested in see how, you know, Father Damien does that, you know, like, is it, because I'm sure it's going to be much more than just, you know, you use these paints and this, but there's going to, I imagine there's going to be prayer involved in it. There's going to be, you know, hopefully some talk about, you know, like how, what images, you know, work, what images don't work. And, you know, but it'll, you know, hopefully be, you know, a way for everybody, you know, at the workshop to, you know, to actually deepen in their own, you know, I have no fear at all that Father Damien's, you know, inviting me there because he wants to convert me to Christianity. But, yeah, so I'm really, you know, interested in, you know, how to take art, you know, and not just doing it for the sake of trying to create something beautiful or trying to do something that, you know, that people will appreciate or, you know, think you're a good person because you can, you know, do something that's beautiful. But to, you know, how do you do that to teach or to even for yourself to understand Buddhism in a deeper way, understand. Yeah, connection with other people in a deeper way. So this is actually the kind of the first time I've really tried to talk about this subject, and so this was kind of an experiment for me tonight, just to see what would come out. Never actually really talked about that aspect of using art, but I think I've said more than enough, and I'll leave that for our reflection for this evening.
Quando mai non lo mai mai sapevo.